Rob, Danny, thank you very much. It's a treat to be here. This is Dennis's terrific book, which isn't only smart, it's important, and I think incredibly timely, because I really do think this issue of diplomacy, statecraft now versus military options is really coming to a crunch in a variety of theaters. And this book, Dennis, couldn't be better timed, and I think more well-informed. And as someone who was in the back of the plane for 4 of those years, I can attest not only to the accuracy of the book, but also its insight. So it's a treat to be here today. Rob and Dennis just asked me to spend, this is his show, spend just a few minutes commenting on Dennis's opening remark. And I've been feverishly taking notes. I was thinking the other day, going back to the very beginning of the Iraq War, pre-Iraq War, I've often asked myself, what were you thinking at the time? And one of the things I wrote back then, which I'm reminded of, is that whenever I heard the president speak about Iraq, particularly his democratic vision, which is always what appealed to me, I always felt like I was listening to a man describing a beautiful carved mahogany table. God, it was beautiful, just beautiful walnut and wonderfully carved. And then I turned it over and it had only one leg. And as I look back, it all really starts there. Dennis talked about leverage. If leverage is the sine qua non of statecraft and negotiation. And the fact is, the president gave us a beautifully carved vision and had only one leg. And that leg itself was pretty puny. It was 144,000 American soldiers and their families. And basically, those 144,000 people and their families, men and women, have in effect carried the whole burden of what was meant to be one of the greatest transformative initiatives ever in the history of American foreign policy, to invade a country half a world away and transform its politics. And so for me, the problem starts there. Someone at the Pentagon told me the other day that they have a saying that division without resources is a hallucination. Vision without resources is a hallucination. And I think historians will look back at the Bush-Iraq policy as a massive hallucination of vision without resources. You cannot will the ends without willing the means. And we never willed the means. And therefore, we undertook, as I said, one of the I can't imagine a bigger project, going into the heart of the Arab Muslim world and trying to take a state there and tilt it from that direction to that direction. And we did it without making them fight, all of us. Bill Maher had this right, that great strategic thinker. And he's actually a very smart guy. In his book, When You Ride Alone, You Ride with Bin Laden, they never made him fight all of us. Not all of America, not all of Europe, not all of the progressive elements in the Arab world. And that's why we're in my view, the mess we're in today. So let's talk a little about Danny's point about leverage, kind of what's been missing. And I see kind of 3 weaknesses that have deprived us of that leverage you identified, Danny, which I think is totally the issue here. First is U.S., second I'll talk about allies, and third, I'll talk about internal to the administration. It seems to me that sine qua non of leverage is to first have agreement within the administration. I think one of the great misreadings is that this is an internally united administration. I've covered a few in my day. This is the most divided administration on the core issues that it's undertaken of any that I've certainly experienced. After all, they can't make up their mind whether they're for regime change or change of behavior. In Iraq or Iran, in Iran or Syria, And I would suggest even, you know, had they had a chance, China. Well, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And leverage starts with knowing where you're going and having an internal consensus on that, it seems to me, Denny, from top to bottom. And because this administration could never make up its mind, whether it was for regime change or regime change of behavior, in particular in Syria, in the Palestinian Authority, when Arafat was there, and in Iran, it's gotten neither. It's gotten the worst of all worlds. And we have to include North Korea in this. North Korea and Iran basically went out and bought Bush insurance. And Bush insurance is a nuclear weapon. And I think it's too late. There is no stopping them. One of the real misreadings that Rob Litwack, I think, has pointed out in his excellent book on rogue states has to do with the Libya switch, which, as you recall, you know, happened about a year after we invaded Iraq, which many people in the administration cite as, look, it's working. We invaded Iraq. Gaddafi saw what we did. He called Roto-Rooter and said, oh, my God, I've got nukes in the basement. Somebody come and take them away. That is not at all what happened. There was a one-year secret negotiation led primarily by the Brits, thank God, with Gaddafi for a very explicit trade. You give up your nuclear program, and we will give you regime security. That's how that deal happened. That is not a position we have ever taken with Iran or with Syria. And I would suggest, we certainly didn't do it with North Korea until it was way too late. And I would suggest that was the beginning of the inability to get leverage. There was no internal consensus on where the pressure points should be and how far they should extend. Second problem with leverage, and it's a particular problem in the Middle East, is that we're up against an enemy that plays by what I like to call Hama rules. Hama rules are no rules at all. Syria and Iran, we both know, have been directly complicit in killing Americans. I would suggest they have not paid any significant price for that. And in this neighborhood, people can smell power at 100 paces. And they know when they're paying and when they're not paying. And the fact is, we've never gained any military leverage on them for killing Americans. It's so bad now, you may have noticed the New York Times, when we even write that Iran was involved in maybe selling or providing special charges to the Iraqi insurgents, we have to qualify it with so many. This may be a leak. This may not be true because the administration's credibility is so low. That's a pretty sad state of affairs. So first of all, leverage. The first leverage comes from having an enemy who plays by no rules and is killing your people, and you have found no effective response at the state level. Secondly, as those of you who follow my work know, you're not going to get leverage on Iran or Syria, for that matter, until unless you bring down the price of oil. I'll give you one very simple statistic from Bloomberg. In 2005, Iran earned $44 billion from oil, which was about, this was the last full year statistics I had, which was about 80% of government receipts. The rest is basically pistachios and carpets. Okay. Iran spent in that year $25 billion on government subsidies, subsidies of food, gasoline, 39 cents a gallon, housing, mortgages, student loans, and university education. Massive subsidies. Let's see, $44 billion income, $25 billion on subsidies. What does that tell you? It tells you if you brought the price of oil down by about 40%, Iran's entire government budget would be going to subsidies. There is a term for that in economics. It's called unsustainable. But the real fact is, rather than ask every American to sacrifice just a little, 50 cents a gallon, tax. Rather than ask every American to sacrifice just a little, we asked a few Americans, 144,000 to be exact, to make the ultimate sacrifice. And as a result of that, we have no leverage. Now, some of you may have seen my work on what I call the first law of petropolitics. It's very simple. The first law of petropolitics is that the price of oil and the pace of freedom operate in an inverse correlation. I basically demonstrated this by graphing the price of oil from 1979 to 2005. And if you graph the price of oil, average OPEC price, from 1979 to 2005, the graph looks like this. $70 a barrel. 1990s, $10 a barrel. 2005, back to $70 a barrel. Round numbers. Then what I did was I took the Freedom House and Fraser Institute Freedom Indexes for four countries, Venezuela, Iran, Russia, and Nigeria. And I overlaid it on the price of oil, their Freedom Index. You know what it looks like? Looks like that. What does that tell you? It tells you the price of oil and the pace of freedom operate in an inverse correlation. When oil was $20 a barrel, Bush looked into Vladimir Putin's soul and saw a good man down there. Okay, you look into Putin's soul at $70 a barrel, you'll see Gazprom, Lukos, Izvestia, Pravda, and every government institution he swallowed, courtesy of $70 a barrel. At $20 a barrel, Iran elected Ahmadinejad, who called for a dialogue of civilizations. $70 a barrel, Iran is calling for the destruction of Israel and says the Holocaust is a myth. One thing I can promise you, at $20 a barrel, the Holocaust will not be a myth. That is nonsense that you can only afford at $70 a barrel. Do we want to get that leverage? No, no. That's your mahogany table with just one leg. We don't want to do what it takes to get that leverage. And without that leverage, you're really going to be left with very few options. Third thing, it seems to me, when you talk about leverage in Iraq and vis-a-vis Iran, in Iraq, it seems to me that we're in a situation now, which is hard to create. It's a trick, where we are everyone's target and everyone's protector. We are everyone's target and everyone's protector. We're the Shiites' target, some of them, and we're their protectors. We're the Sunnis' target, and we're their protectors. We're the Saudis' target. Our occupation there is illegal, and we're their protectors. In private, they say you cannot go. When you're in a situation where you're everyone's target and everyone's protector, you're in that situation they say about a poker game. When you're in a game of poker and you don't know who the sucker is, it's probably you. Okay? Well, we are at a poker table, and we don't know who the sucker is, because it's us. We are everyone's target and everyone's protector, and you cannot have leverage. What does that mean? It means everyone has leverage but you. That's what it means, because it means everyone has choices but you. They can seek our protection, or they can attack us, any one of these parties. And that's why for a year I've been arguing for a firm withdrawal date. Because only when we have a firm withdrawal date will they have to pay retail for their political positions and not wholesale. Right now, we have created a floor in Iraq where everyone there gets to have their politics, in my view, wholesale. No leverage can come out of that. Seems to me the problem we have with our allies now is an equal problem of no leverage. Our real choice here right now is between neocons and cons. Yeah, con men, okay? That's the real choice we face today. We can opt with the neocon strategy of use of force, or we can go with the cons. The cons are the Europeans. This is not complicated, folks. One EU decision, very clear, that says we will impose complete economic sanctions on you, Iran, until and unless you abide by all UN Security Council resolutions, would end this thing tomorrow. Or it would certainly bring it to a head with the kind of leverage that Denny has talked about. We're sanctioned out. The people who have the ability to exercise the leverage that would be decisive or trigger what Dennis discusses in his Iran section in this book, that internal Iranian debate, are the Europeans. They will not use it. Hence our situation. We are caught between neocons and cons. And that is a very, very difficult place to generate any leverage from. Third thing, it seems to me, you have the internal habits, makeup. Dennis talks a lot about this in the book. of this administration. I saw the funniest John Stewart routine a couple weeks ago. It was about the administration. Said they'd went out and hired in the fifth year of the war a war czar to actually manage the war. It was on John Stewart, wasn't it? That couldn't have been in real life. Couldn't have been in real life that in the fifth year of the war now, they got a war czar to coordinate. Who was doing that before? I mean, there was no one in that job? Well, apparently not. They hired a war czar in the fifth year of the war. Dennis talked about public diplomacy. We have Karen Hughes. She does public diplomacy. When you have to have a separate office for public diplomacy, what does that say? Either you have a president who's capable of doing public diplomacy, or no State Department office can do it. That office is either redundant or doomed to failure. If you don't have a president who's your war czar, I mean, it's like, I know they've, No Child Left Behind is important, but you got something better to do? They hired a war czar in the fifth year of the war. How could you possibly generate any leverage internal to the administration when you've never had anyone, it seems to me, coordinating at the very highest level those issues? They have an office for public diplomacy. I covered Secretary Baker with Dennis. He was his own public diplomat, believe me. He knew when to slam the folder shut. He knew just which messages to drop. He knew just which leaks to put out. This is not something you outsource to Bangalore. Okay. That's part of your essential leverage. Last thing I would point to, because Dennis focuses on this book, and that's intelligence. And it seems to me, I believe for a long time, from the day I walked into Iraq the first time, that we have never come to terms with the real intelligence failure in Iraq. Rob, if I ever leave the New York Times, I'm going to call you, and I'm going to say I'd like to come to the Washington Institute, and what I'd like to do is a study. I'd like to do one of your papers. Maybe you've already done it, or, you know, I don't know, but it would be called Iraq 1991 to 2003. Because I think the real intelligence failure was not WMD. It was what happened to Iraqi society, the pulverization and traumatization, the Shiification in terms of Iranian influence, and the Wahhabification of the Sunni community in Iraq between 1991 and 2003. Friends, we defeated the Flintstones. And then we let Bedrock get looted. And then we decided to rebuild the place. The real truth is, the sad truth, sad because this was also a journalistic failure. I think Iraq was a rotten fruit that was just about to fall off the tree, and we decided to pluck it. And now, as I said, we broke it and we own it. The real intelligence failure was what was going on in Iraqi society, how traumatized and pulverized it was, by the way, by UN sanctions, the first war, the Iran-Iraq war. And we are trying to build a progressive society, and it pains me to see how difficult this is, because I still think it's so important, out of the most traumatized country one could possibly imagine. So I think when you put all of this together and you go through Dennis's criteria in the book of what it takes to get leverage, to have a consensus, to know where you're going, to base it on real intelligence, not faith-based intelligence, to have allies who can really deliver, you really see what we have today is a mahogany table with one leg. And I don't think that leg is going to stand much longer. Thank you.